from PRX, this is the Moth Radio Hour. I'm Catherine Burns from The Moth, and I'll be your host this time. The Moth is true stories told in front of a live audience. Coming up, a Quaker is tested in an almost unbelievable struggle to forgive.
The Moth Radio Hour is produced by Atlantic Public Media in Woods Hole, Massachusetts, and presented by the Public Radio Exchange, PRX.org.
Our last story is from Hector Black, who was 88 years old at the time of the telling. We first heard about Hector's story when he was interviewed for the Oral History Project StoryCorps. Hector is an organic farmer who lives outside of Nashville, and he wears denim overalls wherever he goes. He's the only storyteller to whom I've ever said the following. You know that part of your story where you get arrested during the Civil Rights Movement and Martin Luther King personally leads a protest on your behalf, and then his wife comes over and cooks for your family while you're in jail? You need to cut that because it's the least important part of your story. A warning, Hector's story centers around an act of violence, so you may want to pause this program for 15 minutes if you're with kids. Here's Hector Black, live at the Moth.
Thank you. The story I want to tell tonight begins in the late 60s when my wife and I and our three little girls, we moved to Atlanta because we wanted to be a part of the civil rights movement, and the headquarters were there for all the different organizations. And we got a job in a very poor black neighborhood, and there were a lot of kids used to come over to our house and play, and one of them was named Patricia. She's 8 years old. Looked like her hair hadn't been braided in many years and almost just terrible, and impetigo sores down her legs. And she kind of fastened herself onto our family. She was 1 year older than our oldest girl. Her mother was an alcoholic, and often they had no place to sleep, so they'd come over to our house when their mother lost the apartment, and they'd spend the night with us. And then when it came time for us to leave, she asked if she could come with us. And my wife and I said yes. And we went eventually to rural Georgia, and she lived there with us and blossomed. She had a beautiful sense of color. She made her high school graduation dress, painted a mural on the high school wall. She went on and graduated with highest honors from Fisk and got a degree in library science and went back to Atlanta, working in the public library with children such as she had been, often unloved and uncared for. She had a house in a changing neighborhood. And one night in November, she came home late from work, and a crack addict who was stealing for his habit saw no light on in her house and went around the back, broke in the window, stole some things, and took him to the local crack house, got his first hit of crack. He was walking around the neighborhood again, and still no light on, so he wanted a massive dose of crack, so he took a whole bunch of things. And Trish came home while he was gathering them up. He hid in a closet. She opened the closet door and fell backwards, and he tied her hands behind her back. And I learned later that they had a conversation together which sounded exactly like Patricia. She told him to get help with his drug habit. She told him where there was food in the refrigerator. He told her to put burglar bars on the back of the house and always leave a light on. And he asked about the sewing dummies that were in the house, and She told him that a woman named Susie, my wife, had taught her how to sew, and she made bridal gowns as a sideline for income. He got a lot of stuff and got a major hit of crack. Coming by the house again, he thought she would be free by now. But the lights were still out. So he went in again. And he asked for sex. She said, "You'll have to kill me first." And so he strangled her and violated her body. When we learned about this, it was the darkest thing that had ever happened to our family. We'd known death, but not like this, at the hand of another human being. I'm a Quaker. You know, I don't believe in violence. And I yelled out, "I'll kill the bastard." I was furious. Furious at what he had done to our child. I wanted him to hurt. It's very beautiful where we live in Tennessee, along a state scenic wild river, and I'd go walking. And these visions of what had happened to Trish would come crashing in on me, and I couldn't control them. They would just come and haunt me, no matter where I was or how beautiful it was around me. It was like he had control over me. He was pushing my head in the mud. I wanted to know who he was. I wanted to know what had happened to him that made it possible for him to do such a deed. My first reaction was that he was a monster. He was no human being. He deserved no compassion from me. And little by little, I learned a bit about his life. He was born in a mental hospital. When he was 11 years old, his mother took him and his younger brother and little sister to a swimming pool. And she was saying God was asking her to drown them as enemies of God. He and his little brother got away and stood there while she drowned his little sister in front of him. And at one point later on, he told me he felt relief that she was not going to be tormented any longer. I couldn't help but think what I would be like if the woman who brought me into the world had tried to destroy my life. It wasn't that I was trying to excuse what he had done. But I felt for him as another human being suffering. There was a hearing in Atlanta, the final hearing in his case. I'd written the judge earlier on the advice of a friend of mine who was against the death penalty and told the judge how much we loved Patricia and how much a part of our life she was. My youngest girl couldn't remember life without Patricia. At the hearing, they read all the charges against him. And I just sat with my wife, Susie, and held her hand and cried, and I was thankful I was deaf, that I missed, couldn't hear a lot of what they said. After he was sentenced to life without possibility of parole, those of us who knew Trish were given an opportunity to say how the crime had affected us. Her cousin got up and said, "I hate you, Ivan Simpson," that's his name. "I hate you because you took my beloved cousin away from me. I hate you because you'll see the dawn and she'll never see the dawn again. And I hate you because my taxes are going to feed you." She was weeping. And then it was my turn, and I printed out a statement because I didn't know how steady my voice would be. And again, I just said how much we loved her, that she was not our daughter by any claim of birth, but she was our daughter by every claim of love. And at the end, I said, "I don't hate you, Ivan Simpson, but I hate with all my soul what you did to my daughter." And then the very last thing I had to say, is as though I was almost turned around, he was behind me, and I turned around and faced him when I said my last, that I wished for all of us who had been so wounded by this crime, I wish that we might find God's peace, and I wish this for you also, Ivan Simpson. And our eyes met for the first time. The tears were streaming down his cheeks. I'll never forget the look. It's like a soul in hell. They were going to lead him away, knowing he'd spend the rest of his life, he'd die in jail. And he asked to come to the microphone, and twice, with the tears streaming down his cheeks, he said, "I'm so sorry for the pain I have caused. I'm so sorry for the pain I've caused." That night I couldn't sleep. I kept thinking about this, and I felt he was a man off the street. He had nothing, and he'd given me the only thing he had. He'd asked me to forgive him in those words. And I know he could have said, "To hell with all of you, my life is over." But he didn't. And I knew then that I had forgiven him. And I felt a peace that I hadn't had in a long time. And I felt a great burden lifted from me. I started writing to him. He wrote back. And one of the things he said was that he missed God's touch ever since he had killed Patricia. He felt as though God had abandoned him. But he said he felt he heard God's voice by way of compassion in what I'd said in the courtroom. we sent him a Christmas package. And I said, my God, what are you doing? What are you doing, you know, sending a Christmas present to the man who murdered your daughter? And I knew I had to do it. Because I think when you forgive someone, you start to care about them again. And I knew he had no one in the world. We had a small group of people in Cookeville. We thought we'd maybe get together with other people who had lost loved ones to violence like this. And I remember one woman whose brother had been killed 15 years before coming in and telling her story. Her brother was a doctor. He was killed by a man off the streets, to her, a nobody. And she was as angry as if it had happened the day before. And I knew I didn't want, that was no way to live. That was not life. A friend of mine told me that when you hate, you take poison and you expect the other person to die. And I think that's true. My wife and I went to South Georgia to visit Ivan in prison. It took a long time to arrange it. But we felt it was, again, something we needed to do. So I think what happened there was we were sitting down and talking together for 2.5 hours. It was just extraordinary. And because I'm very deaf, I was sitting very close to him. He was unshackled, of course. And when it got time for us to leave, he stood up and I did too, and it seemed the most natural thing in the world that we had our arms around one another. And it was an unbelievable moment that I could have my arms around the man who murdered. And I think forgiveness is possible for the worst. And I do believe we all need forgiveness, God knows. Thank you.
That was Hector Black. Hector served in the Army during World War II and graduated from Harvard in 1949. When we were working on the story, Hector and I spoke a lot about how we found compassion for Ivan Simpson by focusing on the abused child Ivan once was. Hector said, "I couldn't help thinking that here we are, the richest country the world has ever known, the most powerful, and there was no one for this little boy." Our friends at the public radio show Radiolab recently visited Hector in Tennessee and had him read a number of the letters to and from Ivan Simpson. To hear those letters and to see pictures of Patricia, go to themoth.org. That's it for this episode of the Moth Radio Hour. We hope you'll listen next time.